So I thought I would do something different tonight rather than the planned agenda. How many people went to the talk on Thursday last week? So not quite a few here didn't. Roberta, you were there? Oh, you didn't come. Okay. Okay. So I thought it would be very interesting. There was a teacher there, and I'll pass around pictures of what he looked like, just as people can have a sense of what I'm talking about. So I thought tonight we could talk about what is a genuine teacher, and also reactions people are having to the book, What Makes You Not a Buddhist? So I've been hearing different things from people. And then we'll just see where the conversation goes. But I'd like to have a more open conversation. But I'd like to make a few comments first. This teacher that we saw last week, his name is Keelung Rinpoche, and this was the first time I actually met him, but I did a weekend program with him this past weekend, and Michael Fagan was there as well. It was interesting, after the talk, people were saying to me from the group, Mary was there and some other people were there, they said, he's really nice. He seems really gentle, not like the book we're reading, not like the guy that we're reading in this book, who makes me, I feel personally insulted by this book. This teacher seems really nice and gentle. So I wanted to talk a little bit about what is a genuine teacher and what's it all about and why a teacher is important. So this teacher is called Keelung Rinpoche, and the word Rinpoche means precious one, precious teacher, gem. It's a gem, right? Yeah. Rinpoche is a gem, gem. So full of marvelous qualities or rich qualities. And he's also a tulku, that's T-U-L-K-U, and that means emanation body. So in Tibet, they have a 1,000-year-old tradition of actually recognizing teachers who attained quite a level of realization in one lifetime and then had another incarnation in a subsequent lifetime where they left letters and instructions where they would be found. And there's a whole process where they actually work to find out what this teacher is, if he recognizes previous objects from his previous life. So that is a long tradition in Tibet. And always the question is, when you meet a teacher, how does he make you feel, or how does she make you feel? What happens in terms of your heart? Do you feel some sense of an opening and a possibility? So kind of where is the connection there? And I think, it's interesting. Some teachers we connect with and others we don't have such a strong connection to. And what we're trying to do here is give you a foundation of Buddhist teachings and also introduce you to different teachers. So there are two other teachers that will be coming this summer in August, a teacher named Khandro Rinpoche that Michael Fagan studied with extensively, and she's on our website as well. And she is also a Rinpoche and a tulku, an incarnate, reincarnated teacher. And she's a very powerful teacher, so you'll have an opportunity to see her if you would like. I think it's also in Newton, right? I think she's at the Newton Theological Seminary.
Same place, yeah.
And she's going to be coming August 18th, 19th, and 20th. That's Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night, the end of August. Well, actually, that would be like the third week of August. And then the other teacher that we've met who will be coming is Anam Thubten Rinpoche. And some of you saw him. Several of you saw him. Yes.
Last year
he was here. And a number of people are actually in the study group that's local in Waltham. So he'll be having a public talk on Friday, the 21st of August, and then a weekend program on the 22nd, 23rd. So I highly recommend having the experience of meeting him, and if you can do the weekend program, that would be really great, because he always sits with his students. He comes out early. I've never seen that before with any teacher. And he's just there. He just sits there. And he does usually a guided meditation, and then there'll be a break and a talk. So he is actually the cousin of this teacher, Kilam Rinpoche, interestingly enough. So there's lots of different cross connections here. So again,
what is Rinpoche? I mean, is that like a...
It's an honorific term for a teacher that's a high teacher.
Well, it actually refers specifically to a tulku, a reincarnated lama. In other words, you recognize this person's an emanation of some person who attained some level of realization. So if you study the bodhisattva levels, you'll find that when these teachers become... acquire a position of eminence in terms of realization. They're not necessarily arrived at the final Buddha level, but they are a very high degree of attainment that they indicate some kind of, this has been specific to Tibet, where there's a kind of a rediscovery of that. It's not clear always whether it's the actual seeming person who was incarnated to begin with, because a lot of times it's just called what they call blessing tulkus. It's sort of like an office of... this is a complicated subject.
Right. There are many.
As long as you open the door, we have to...
But you don't have to go into it too much.
No, but we just need to know that basically the idea is that they're recognized teachers who reincarnate life after life to benefit beings.
Right. And there's a process of recognizing them. So it's, they check. It's not just made up. But it's what we're presenting here is fundamental Buddhist teachings, but through the lineages that we're familiar with the Tibetan steep teachers. So fundamentally, however, the basic meditation instruction that we give and the practices we do, you would find similarities in other Tibetan Buddhist groups. So just so that you kind of get a sense of that. And I think, people have been asking, and I think at some point we will do a class or at least a talk on more about lineage and where the Zen people fit in and Theravadins, and there are a lot of different lineages and how are they different. So we will we'll do something, because I know people have been asking about that. So what I wanted to highlight is that these teachers that are tulkus or rinpoches have gone through a very rigorous discipline of training. And I was reading more about the life of Kilam Rinpoche. He was born in 1970, and as we know, the communists took over Tibet and decimated the system there in terms of the Buddhist system and the monasteries. So he was in a nomadic family. And basically, there were a lot of auspicious signs before, during, and after his birth, but they kept everything very hidden. And he was trained in secret, you could say, because they were not allowed to show their Buddhist training, and they had to keep everything very secret. It's very dangerous. And he told a story on retreat that about his parents and their devotion. And he said, in the middle of the night, they would get up and go out in the tent, out of the tent, and put prayer flags on the top of the tent. And then they'd go back like 4 hours later before dawn and take them down. And that was the way they were able to somehow keep their heart connection with the Buddha's teachings alive. And there's, you know, I think about all of our possibilities in this country. We can read any book we want. We can do basically any practice we want. And the preciousness of that situation. So he was educated basically in secret and did a 3-year retreat. So these people have really held the teachings in a very precious way, and they have been made available to us. So I guess my point is that there's different ways that teachers manifest. And the reason I picked this book, What Makes You Not a Buddhist, is because I knew it would upset you. She says gleefully. In fact, one of my friends, I was at this program, the Karmapa, the 17th Karmapa was in New York, and she said, oh, yeah, I looked at that book. I would never give that to my students. And I said, well, I'm going to. So the reason we picked it is because it's very provocative. So the point here is not to, like, help you fall asleep or zone out or feel like we want you to really examine and think and challenge and ask and wonder. And I was just looking again at the first two chapters, and it really does make you kind of come up short. But what I want to stress here is that we've also laid the ground for this with the previous course, which is Lojong. So what you need to remember is when you read this book and you feel some kind of clutch, like, oh, I feel insulted, or I can't believe this is a Buddhist teacher that's saying these things, then you ask, why do I feel insulted? What's this? How is it affecting me? What concept do I have that's being undercut here? And why is my reaction so strong? So this guy, Dzongsar Kensei Rinpoche, is a real trickster. And I talked with one of my friends today about the book, and he said, oh boy, it's nothing like seeing this guy in person. So this is the mild version, I have to say. So why would a teacher manifest that way? He could certainly be gentle, nice, unassuming, but it is really to the benefit of the students to get them a kind of out of their fog, you could say. And what's the point of all this meditation and practice and study anyway? And we talked about this way back in the fall when I gave basically a view about meditation practice and Buddhist teachings. And I talked about the two veils. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. The two veils? So the basic view is that we all hold Buddha nature within. That's, we are no other than Buddha. We really are not. But we don't really know it. We don't believe it. We don't feel it because we feel a lot of whatever arises for us or confusion. So we started with the klesha veils. Do you remember that? Mm-hmm. And then a lot of discussion about kleshas. And the two veils, if you're speaking of two, there's sometimes three, but that the klesha veils we talked about being more accessible because they're so vivid, right? They arise in some way. Or they can be subtle, but once we start meditating, we start to notice, oh, I'm always making shopping lists every time I sit down. Or you start to notice your patterns that repeat over and over. So there's that obscuration, which is like cataracts almost over your eyes. There's some fogginess that arises by not seeing clearly. And the other is what's called the knowledge veils. And that's harder to access. And that's what we talk about as non-self, which we brought up quite a lot, and which is a really key concept. And it's a concept, but it's more than a concept. So it's really a fundamental understanding of the way things are. And that's what rubs us the wrong way, fundamentally. That's very irritating when we start to take apart our world that feels so together in some way. And the other part of the knowledge veils is the knowledge of phenomena and the way things are. And we see the world as quite solid, but as we start really penetrating through our veils that cover over our view, we start to see through that. And that's really the view of emptiness. And I left that for Michael Fagan because I can't ever explain it. That's the hardest one. So that wasn't very nice, but anyway. You're stuck with it. So these things are hard to get, and we have to keep circling around and around and keep coming back to them, but they're very, very important. So the way things are presented here, I just want you to really think about mixing practice with the view. And here, we're in the book, we're getting the view, and your practice is what will reveal the truth of what's being told to you here, which is that you will start to see, you'll examine whether it's true or not, and then you'll start to take it apart for yourself. So the teachers that are challenging, in fact, even the teachers that seem very nice and gentle when you meet them maybe in a public talk, if you become the student of that teacher, you're going to get the challenging part along with it, because if they take on a student, ultimately they want to see your own liberation. And what are we liberating from? Our concepts, our fixed ideas, our solidifications. So all of that is undermined by a teacher's skillful means, and it can come in many forms. So it's so I think just remembering to think and mix Tonglen practice, really work with the Lojong slogans, really keep going back over them and examining what comes up for you, and really look at the slogans and see where you can apply them. I think that will help. So I think I'll just stop there, and I just would like to talk maybe first about people's reaction to Keelong Rinpoche, and also, you know, we can talk more about the book and what you might be coming up against in working with the book, or maybe you love it.
Mm-hmm. I thought it was very nice to be in his presence. But I guess I got bothered by not really hearing him very well. And it started to disconnect me a little, mm-hmm. and make me just feel sorry that I couldn't really join with him more.
Mm-hmm. And his English is not really great. And in a public talk, he was very different on the weekend because he had a Tibetan text. So he would read the text in Tibetan, and there was also a book we had with the English translation, and he'd have someone read that. And then he was teaching a certain body of work, you know, so it was much more comprehensible that way. So the sound was really difficult, I think, in the public talk. And also, I think that's, you know, just the way he manifested it was a little hard to, you know.
Well, I think he was also trying to
difficult.
Sense who was in the audience.
Yeah.
Get a feeling for, you know, who might be what they were there for. And so he was searching for contact, mm-hmm. communicate. As Emily says, I mean, we had a 5-day weekend with him, and stretching from Friday through Tuesday. And he was quite focused, and in that situation, he was very clear mm-hmm. with his language. So it was a very different setup. And of course, I sensed personally that this was hard, going to be hard.
Yeah.
I mean, I had a hard time hearing
right.
exactly what he was trying to say. You know, a little muffled, and his accent was really thick at that point. So I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
But, you know, he did seem to warm up. I mean, there was a sense of warmth, a real sense of just being there for us on some level.
Yes, I mean, it's very powerful just being his presence sometimes. Very glad I was there, but half of every sense.
Yeah.
I was just desperate to really make up.
Right, and you were in the back, I think, too. It might have been even a little harder to hear back there.
Do you think you'll have audio of it so that you can hear everything?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't think they recorded it.
I don't think they did.
Your recording said, excellent.
Yes, I don't believe they did record it. No. They just made the audio, projected it, but they didn't have the sound very clear. Yeah. What did you think, Janet?
I feel actually similar to Diane, you know, that it was just wonderful just to be in his presence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he had just had this incredibly calming, centered way about him, you know, that just emanated sort of love. You know, and so you sort of felt that with just being around him, but it was frustrating,
yeah,
because you really couldn't really hear what he was saying. But it also seemed like it was kind of basic. I don't mean that in a bad way, but and so you could sort of sit back and just not sort of be tested with being challenged by what he was saying necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was good. I liked that about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I didn't feel like I had to get a lot out of the night to have to feel like it was worthwhile.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I'm really glad that I went.
Mm-hmm.
I was listening to a different talk by Dzongtsa Rinpoche, and he said a couple of things to us, and he's speaking here very directly to Americans. And first of all, he said, you cannot be Tibetan, you're American, which is very important because there's some students who try to be Tibetan and it doesn't work. But then he said something else really interesting. He said, you know, I was brought up with this, because he was a tulku, so he was trained in Buddhist teachings of all kinds, right from the time he was a very small child, just the way a violinist in the West might be trained from the age of 3 in order to be a good violinist, but more than that. And he said, you didn't get any kind of training like this, yet you came here and somehow you connected to the Dharma, and that's really wonderful. And that's what he had to say about us. You're here. Somehow you figured it out on your own and got here. And I thought that was a very open and kind thing for him to say.
Yeah.
That's what I the last Tupton broadcast, I think there's one I missed recently, but one right before that, where he talked for almost 40 minutes, repeated, just be on the path, just be on the path. And all I ask is that you stay on the path and be on the path. The path is your own, and you can't show it to anyone. It is your... Anyway, and I thought... After about 30 minutes, I thought, no, this sure is repetitious. But it just stayed with me,
yes.
And I wrote down, I had written some things that he said, two sentences, and I keep looking at it, and it's just such a wonderful... See, that's very comforting to me, and it's a beautiful... it's wonderful you're on the path. Just stay on the path. That, to me, is quite a lot for where I am.
Trungpa Rinpoche made us do so much sitting. Before we got Vajrayana teachings, we had to do at least a month of retreat sitting and a 3-month seminary, which alternated retreat sitting and teachings. And even during the teaching period, there was at least 2 hours of sitting a day. He made us sit a lot. And he made it so that we had to put a lot of effort into it, and he kept coming back. Or most of us did. There were people who ran away. So we, as the teachers here, feel happy that we make you sit for an hour, and sometimes you don't want to hear what's being said, and you keep coming back. I think that's wonderful, because we're trying to put a very, the view, what we got from our teacher, we're trying to give away. And the fact that everyone here comes here makes us happy.
Good karma.
I think another thing people always ask me is, well, what's the goal? I feel like I have to have a goal. And, you know, there must be a goal here. And so it's interesting, because that's, we all have that question, and I do hear that a lot. And so the answer is, yes, there's a goal, and no, there is no goal. So it's both, of course. And where does that leave you? It is the journey without goal, I suppose. That's certainly a title and used a lot. But we have to start with a goal, because that gives us a motivation to actually to practice. And it's once we start practicing, then we might get a glimpse of some spacious quality, or we get a glimpse of our confused mind, or whatever it is. And then we just have some inspiration to just keep going with that. And then we see what happens. But ultimately, it's always said that you're just basically discovering your true nature, which is what you have all the time, that you're always carrying that as your true nature. So the journey is one of basically stripping away these obscurations or obstacles or confusion, and allowing that true nature to shine through. So are there any more comments about anything, the book or anything like that, or reactions? Yes.
If you felt insulted, I'd be interested in hearing about that.
Yeah.
Well, I guess something that Michael said, but I don't know if you quoted the book or not, but you said we are not to be Tibetans.
Yeah, we are not Tibetans. It's just a fact. We aren't. We don't speak that language. It's not our culture.
I agree with that. So what I would ask is, well, how do the lineages adapt to
universal
approach?
Such a wonderful question, because we've learned a fair amount of how it came from India to Tibet, and it did change a lot there, okay? They had to take those teachings, they had to translate them. The culture was so different. They didn't have the Indian caste system to deal with. Or they took some of the metaphysics of India, but they had to change it. All Indian teachings talked about Atman as soul, but then the Buddhists talk about Anatman, non-self, yeah. So they had to work with that. They had to change all kinds of things, and they had to translate. And we have seen that. There's a wonderful book about how Rick Fields.
How the Swans Came to the Lake?
No.
Oh, another book?
Is that it?
Buddhism Coming to America,
you mean?
Yeah, How the Swans Came to the Lake.
Yeah. So, in 1960, for instance, one of the problems with discussing Dharma is that the language wasn't here. The English language was not good enough to talk Dharma, really. And the Dharma translations we had were sort of like King James English. They sounded very theistic and Bible-like and very pious and so on. And several important translators. One was the group that Trungpa Rinpoche started. Another one was Kenpo Sultan Gyatso's. And there were, over time, there were several translation groups that worked very hard. And we now have, we're now enjoying the benefit of that, that we have in English excellent language to discuss Dharma. We have the vocabulary now. We can, you know, sometimes we give it to you in Sanskrit, Tibetan, English. So we have to do things in our own way. But we have to keep the essence of it. Did I ever tell you the, what Pumla Rinpoche said about the cup that holds the tea? Have I talked about that? He said, well...
take away the cup.
If you take away the... Okay, let's say the tea is the essence. That's what's important, right? But in order to receive the tea, you have to have a cup. It won't work for you to hold out your hands for the tea. So, if it's a Tibetan teacup, can you picture that? It's going to be very elaborate. It's either a skull or it's made out of bronze or something, and it may be elaborately decorated. It may have semi-precious gems and carvings on it. And that's a Tibetan one. If it's Japanese, it may be Zen-like. It might be pottery that looks very simple, but is still so clear and that the simplicity shines in it. And he said, okay, what are you going to have here? You have to figure that out. You have to figure that out. Maybe you're going to have a styrofoam cup.
No!
No, we don't have that.
That's the American cup.
Yeah, but we have to actually do something that is somewhat respectful of ritual and fine traditions, including our own. And basically, whatever it is, it has to be sacred. What keeps going is sacredness. The teachings are sacred, our lives are sacred, and one of the hardest things, one of the things that's most important is that you can't get away from the teachings because everything is sacred. So everything from washing the dishes to taking a crap to getting on a bus to making love, there is no... Everything is part of a totally sacred world. There's no closet to hide in that's not sacred. And we have to do that to have American Buddhism. Tremendous respect and discipline and still feel comfortable that we're home. That was a little too long, wasn't it?
That was okay. Well, it's kind of a different rhythm tonight because we can just have some relaxation and ask questions. Do you have something else?
Well, I've been thinking, you asked about if anybody was insulted. I was the insulted person, I guess. And I had trouble on page 17. I met with my 11 to talk about this book because I was upset. And the paragraph at the top.
You want to read it?
Why don't you read it loud?
Well, this is, I mean, some of it isn't to reveal. But Prince Siddhartha no longer needed or wanted the exit elixir of immortality by realizing that all things are assembled, that deconstruction is infinite, and that not one of the components in all creation exists in an autonomous, permanent, pure state. He was liberated. Anything that is put together, which we now understand to be everything, and its impermanent nature are bound together. Just like water in an ice cube. When we put an ice cube in our drink, we get both. And I really liked the ice in the water. And just when Siddhartha looked at someone walking around, even the healthiest person, he saw this person as both simultaneously living and disintegrating. And I'm I'm still good, you know, here. And I think this doesn't sound like a fun way to live, but it can be an amazing ride to see both sides. It might be great satisfaction. And I circled great satisfaction because what I heard from the Lojong was, we're not supposed to have be satisfied. Forget it. If you're satisfied, that's, you know, ego. So, but it's not like a roller coaster of hope and disappointment going up and down. Seeing things in this way, they begin to dissolve all around us. Your perception of phenomena transform, and in a way, it becomes clearer. This is where I had trouble. It is so easy to see how people get caught up in the roller coaster, and you naturally have compassion for them. One of the reasons is you have compassion is that permanence is so obvious. Yet they just don't see it.
Yeah.
And I find this incredibly condescending.
We don't see it.
I just thought the arrogance of, you know, well, those poor people, you know, I just like, look, you, please.
You just put yourself in just a position of, I mean, I'll restate that only differently. It's so easy to see how I get caught up in the roller coaster and I naturally have compassion for myself. One of the reasons I have compassion is because impermanence is so obvious and yet I just don't see it.
Okay. Yeah, that's great. That sounds great. Good. It sounds like he does this and the poor other people don't. I mean, it felt like he was elevating himself and looking down. That sounds great, what you said. If he said that, good. But
he doesn't say it like that. Yeah. There's a passage on page 10 that is, it just has this scolding, arrogant tone to it.
Oh, let's see.
It's more his tone, and it's almost written like, oh, I've heard this before. If it wasn't from a rabbi or read in a self-help book, I've heard it.
Go ahead. Read the part that bothers
Page 10.
Yeah.
When that anything is displeasing, we deliberately divert our attention like a mother distracting a child with rattles and toys. If we feel down, we go shopping, we treat ourselves, we go to the cinema, we build fantasies and aim for lifetime achievements, beach houses, plaques, and trophies. I can't relate to that. Early retirement, nice cars, good friends, family, fame, making it into the Guinness Book of World Records. Later in life, we want a devoted companion with whom we can take a cruise or raise pure red poodles. Magazines and television interviews. But it is, it's kind of putting him, it's like he's trying, he's...
Yeah.
There's why be so condescending? I mean, he's talking about people.
Why is it condescending?
It is.
What makes you feel it's condescending?
I think it has a condescending tone.
If you are a renunciate, then basically, and this is what we're heading towards. Now, obviously, we're going to have different degrees of this, but there's a very important chant that we share. Renunciation is the foot of meditation, as it's taught. To this meditator who is not attached to food and wealth, who cuts the ties to this life, grant your blessing so that I have no desire for honor and gain. When you begin to understand that renouncing attachment to all the kinds of entertainment and comforts that this whole culture is built around and constantly driving everybody crazy to keep up with and making everybody miserable in the process because they can't get all of this that they're supposed to have, according to at least convention, you begin to realize this is the cause of suffering. So you start to renounce. You renounce things that you understand give you freedom. When you renounce things, you discover freedom. This is the first, it's an early but a very important step. He is speaking from the point of view of being a renunciate, just simply an impartial observer, seeing how people get caught up. And he's only communicating this because he cares.
It sounds like, to my ears, it sounds like someone who puts other people down to make themselves feel better.
It does.
And I don't need that.
I think we need to clarify the word.
That's how I interpret that.
Yeah, okay.
He says these notions of success are our grown up baby rattles. And, you know, I mean, I understand, you know, being a renunciate, but I'm not a renunciate. I actually have a television.
Oh, we have to clarify what the word renounce means.
Let's work on that.
I had ice cream before I came here.
That's great. You deserve it.
If the renunciates want to have a lifetime of lettuce, wonderful. But that's not what I want.
Okay, so let's see if we can agree on it. Let's see if we can understand what the word renounce means.
Okay, go for it.
Because it doesn't mean necessarily locking yourself up and giving up anything. It's the attachment that is the issue.
Right.
Okay? So we make ourselves unhappy if we have an ice cream and enjoy it, that there's no problem there. If we miss the opportunity to have an ice cream and that makes us unhappy, that means we're attached. We have okay? So all day long, we're attached. We're attached not just to the things we get, we're attached to the things we don't get. So we have all these Lojong slogans. We can look and see, when is there a flicker of envy in my mind? When is there a flicker of resentment? This would be so much better than why do I get angry in traffic, which gets all the attention. Why do I momentarily get upset by someone I care about? What am I attached to? Attached to, not getting or not getting. Okay. If it comes natural to be wealthy, to have many things, and that's not a problem for us, then that's not an issue. It's not having a lot of things. It's continual anxiety that we're not getting them, or continual anxiety that we're going to lose them. That's the attachment. And we burden ourselves with attachment, and that keeps us from being happy. So here's an invitation to us to be happy.
It doesn't. You could have fooled me, because it doesn't sound like an invitation to be happy. It does sound like he's, to me, still like he's looking down his nose at people. I understand what you're saying. I mean, that sounds better.
First of all, this guy's a cinema director, right?
He's a what?
Cinema director. So you've surely seen plenty of movies in which the problem is not that someone has something, but that their resentments, their envies, and so on lead them to making crazy decisions or lead them into unhappiness when they lose it.
I guess I wonder, as we sit here, what do you want for us? I mean, the freedom to find our Buddha nature. I still don't consider myself a Buddhist. I mean, are we, mm-hmm. am I supposed to, have a confirmation and now be a Catholic? Or, when we were reading the Lojong stuff, I remember sitting here